So
far.
At last, the much anticipated how to organise an underground movement. We've all been waiting for this one. So I'll introduce Dr. George Whale.
Well, thank you, Julie, very much for inviting me here to the Southwest Forum. I'm honoured to be here. And thank you, everybody, for turning up to listen to the speeches today. My talk is entitled How to Organise an Underground Movement. Now, I don't have personal practical experience of that because I've never been called upon to do it. There's never been any need to do that. But what I've done today is drawn together bits of knowledge from various experts in the field and try to make sense of them and how they might apply to our situation. Now, as you know, British nationalism is under attack at the moment. We're very much under pressure. People are frightened even to express their ideas. And I would characterise the current situation as a climate of fear. People are afraid to talk, they're afraid to organise. It's a very worrying kind of atmosphere. There are draconian curbs on freedom across the Western world, which are criminalising or prohibiting open exchange of nationalist ideas. These curbs take many forms, including closure of websites, banning of organisations, harassment of leaders, and hate speech laws leading to self-censorship of ideas deemed taboo by the traitor class. This is one of the worst things, I think, that it's a kind of soft totalitarianism. They don't actually need to imprison people for saying bad things or what they consider bad things because people are censoring themselves. They're so frightened of the consequences of losing their jobs, of losing their friends, or even going to prison, that they simply won't talk about the things that they're thinking. So we're losing free speech in this country. I believe that the result of such systematic repression will be to drive the movement underground, and therefore our challenge is to increase by alternative legal means the flow of dissident ideas and activities. Now, before I go into the detail, I'd like to consider our present situation, just remind everybody where we are. And we're in the midst of what the French writer Renaud Camus has characterised as the Great Replacement. Camus said, the Great Replacement is very simple. First you have one people, and then after a generation, you have a different people. And we've seen what's happening in France with huge areas of Paris and other cities being taken over by Muslim populations. This is the Great Replacement in action. And we can see it here in Britain too. The white population is plummeting in some of our major cities. We know that London, white British population of London is somewhere around 40% now, or it was at the last census in 2011. Birmingham down to 53.1%, Bradford down, Slough 34.5% white British. And for England as a whole, less than 80%. Now, I should stress these are old figures. These are from the 2011 census. Goodness knows what the situation is now. We'll find out in 2021, no doubt. Now, this great replacement is most apparent in the schools. If you look at the younger generations, you find whole areas where the schools are dominated by ethnic minorities, where white British kids are in a tiny minority. And, you know, I love the hypocrisy of the left-wingers when they boast about diversity in places like Tower Hamlets in London, where I used to live. Some of the schools there are 95% Bengali, and they talk about them being diverse. I mean, it's absolutely insane. It's absolutely insane. This is the kind of doublespeak we have to deal with. Here are some Muslims praying in a park in Birmingham. Now, if that picture doesn't fill you with terror, there's something wrong with you. There have been some academic studies of the demographic changes in Britain. There's a professor at Oxford University called David Coleman, who has looked at the figures and done his analysis and come to the conclusion that white Britons will be a minority in the country as a whole by 2066. So it's a pretty bleak picture at the moment. And this concept of replacement migration, even organisations such as the UN are using this idea of replacement migration. The idea that they're pushing forward is that because our populations in Western Europe are aging so rapidly, that we're going to need young people from the third world to replace them. Now, what these analyses always exclude is the fact that automation and artificial intelligence are actually replacing jobs. Mm. Within the next few decades, between a third and half of all menial jobs and low-skilled jobs could actually be replaced by machines. So where is the need to bring in all these unskilled workers, these low-skilled workers from the third world? There's absolutely no need. And the second point they never make is that you don't need a massive population in order to be an economically successful country. I used to live in Finland. It's about the same size as Britain, but it's got a population of 6 million people. Fantastic quality of life, fantastic technological companies, economically successful, 6 million people. You don't need to increase our population to 70, 80 million in order to remain economically viable. So, in effect, all this stuff about having to replace our population is a big lie. And underneath it, there's a whole other agenda which has nothing to do with economics, and it's about hatred of the English. Now, one of the consequences of having a rapidly growing ethnic minority population is that they become very emboldened. Now, I don't know, I've got a video here. I don't know if we can play it. But this is an ethnic minority Channel 4 reporter. Hold on, push the volume on.
Our parents who have left Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, the fact of the matter is, the UK is never going to be white again. It's just not going to happen. People can wish it, but it's not realistic. Similarly, our parents who have left Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Muslim countries, for them to think that they can re-establish those countries and the lives that they had there over here, it's not going to happen. And I recognize the fact that that's a big loss for both people, for both sides. But the reality is that we have to move forward. The reality is that we're together going to have to find out what does it mean to be British moving forward? What does it mean to build a society that includes all of us, where it means looking like me and looking like you?
So what she and many like are essentially saying is that we British have to change ourselves to their conception of what Britishness should be in order to make them feel comfortable in our country. This is the kind of arrogance that we're having to deal with, and it's going to get a lot worse.
White politicians at the top.
Yeah, exactly, precisely. And this kind of hatred of the white British, especially and white Europeans, and especially white men, has now become prevalent. And you know, you can say hateful things about white men, and nobody will bat an eyelid. Here's an example. Sit down and let us abolish you. And she's talking about white men, basically. Now, I think a lot of the liberals have this idea that their wonderful structure of equality and diversity will carry on even after the British become a minority. But seriously, can you imagine panels full of Africans and Arabs and Chinese sitting around and deciding how they can improve life for the native British and how they can ensure that the native British get their proper share of things and their proper equality? It's never going to happen. And we know perfectly well from past history of other cultures what happens to a people when they lose control of their own territory, when they lose power and they lose control of their own destiny. It's not a pretty picture. And this cannot be our destiny, and this will not be our destiny. Renaud Camus, the French writer I spoke about earlier, he said there's only one solution to colonisation, which is removal of the coloniser.
Yes.
Now, the Great Replacement, it's not only a matter of physical replacement of the population. To support that whole enterprise, there's a whole structure of official propaganda which is designed to inculcate in our minds the idea that this is perfectly okay. And through state propaganda, they hope to ease this process of population replacement. And many of the organs of the state, particularly organisations like the BBC, are very aggressive in pushing this anti-white agenda. But they do it in quite subtle ways. They do it through drama, for example, by introducing black characters and ethnic minority characters, which historically is usually very inaccurate. But it's all part of this process of trying to convince us that, yes, Europe has always been multicultural, Britain has always been multiracial, so what are you complaining about? This is all perfectly normal. This particular drama called The Miniaturist is set in 1680s Amsterdam. And it's a very typical BBC drama because it's got the full panoply of characters. It's got the feisty feminist who doesn't need a man. It's got the sensitive, persecuted homosexual.
Oh, God.
It's got the aggressive, white, ruling class. It's got the wise black man. And to top it all, it's got the mixed-race baby. This is a typical BBC production. Not just BBC, this is the Royal Shakespeare's Company version of Henry the Sixth from the 15th century. Back to the BBC, a production called The Hollow Crown, which is an adaptation of Shakespeare's history plays. Margaret of Anjou, who incidentally married Henry the Sixth and became Queen of England, apparently is also black. So all of you bigots who are complaining about Prince Harry's choice of bride, you're completely wrong, because back in the 15th century, the entire royal family was black. Again, from the BBC, this is one of the Robin Hood and his Merry Immigrants. And according to the renowned historian Guy Ritchie, who made the film King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, the Knights of the Round Table were also multicultural. Here's Sir Bedivere, straight out of the Congo. And according to Professor Ritchie, King Arthur's wife was also a person of colour.
Oh, a person of colour, yes.
This one made me laugh. It's so absurd. You know, and we laugh about it, and it is funny, and it's ridiculous, and it's insane. But if you put yourself in the position of a kid in school, maybe 9 or 10 years old, he's not seen anything except this. He's never had a proper version of English history. This is all he's ever seen. He's going to start believing that Africans and Arabs and Pakistanis built this country. He's going to get a completely distorted view of his own history and culture. And this is the way that the ruling class is going to dispossess us through the minds of our kids. Mm. And here's an example of the BBC directly targeting children. Here we have our multiracial family of a Roman soldier on the BBC Teach website, which is aimed at small children.
Dear, dear.
Going even further back into ancient Greek mythology, we have Achilles straight out of Compton. And here's our old mate Cheddar Man. Do you remember him? Now, a group of completely impartial, non-political scientists, if you can believe that, they drilled a hole into this 10,000-year-old skull and extracted the DNA. And then through a process of scientific deduction, or perhaps wild speculation, came to the view that he might have been brown. And so The Guardian and other newspapers like that gleefully reported that the so-called first Briton was in fact a black man.
Oh, really?
Now, if you actually look at some of the comments of the scientists working on this project, you can see that they are out-and-out lefties. Tom Booth, an archaeologist at the Natural History Museum who worked on the project, said, "It really shows up that these imaginary racial categories that we have are really very modern constructions, or very recent constructions that really are not applicable to the past at all. This terminology is straight out of the left-wing playbook, straight out of the Marxist playbook." Another scientist, Johan Diekman, a computational biologist at University College London, also a member of the project team, said the connection often drawn between Britishness and whiteness was not an immutable truth. It has always changed and will change. So he's going way beyond his own area of competence and actually predicting that Britishness and whiteness, the connection between them, will change in future. So this is an overtly political statement from somebody who's supposed to be a neutral scientist. And it's a rather chilling example of science being used in the service of state propaganda, which was something the Soviets were very good at. Controlling their scientists to produce propaganda to support the official narrative. Now, while this great replacement is going on and our kids are being bombarded with all this awful propaganda, this anti-white, anti-British propaganda, you would imagine that there would be conservatives in this country who would be opposing it and presenting counter-arguments. But unfortunately, many of our conservatives seem to have gone over to the other side. They've taken on board completely the liberal ideas. They even use the same language as the far left. They are conservatives in all but name. In fact, the alt-right has come up with a fantastic term for them, cuckservative, which is a portmanteau word combining cuckold and conservative. Now, a cuckold is a man who stands by powerless and impotent while his wife is being screwed by another man. And a cuckservative is somebody who stands by while his country is being screwed by the far left. Right. So cuckservative is a really a suitable term for these people. Here's another one. David Cameron, his proudest boast, of all the things that he did as Prime Minister, his proudest boast is that he introduced same-sex marriage.
Shame on him.
Our Prime Minister, like many Prime Ministers before, we call her. Whenever there's a Muslim festival, she makes a little video to appeal to the Muslim community, even using Arabic language to express her welcome and greeting to the Muslim community. It's a sad sight, it's a very sad sight. This is a woman called Anna Soubry, who also postures as a conservative. Now, these people remind me very much of the collaborators in France and Holland during the Second World War. And, of course, this is what happened to them. And I often wonder what you know, if you imagine our wartime generation coming back from the war and going home to their communities and finding them overrun by Third Worlders, their kids being terrorised by grooming gangs, homosexuals elevated to privileged status, getting married and adopting children, the state telling them what they're allowed to say to each other and what they're not allowed to say. I suspect in that situation the only politicians you would see in public would be the ones hanging from the lampposts. Now, there's a very good article on it. There's a website called Mortgage for Green. There's a very good article about how to tell if you're a cuckservative, and these are some of the pointers. If you say it isn't about race, it's about space when discussing immigration, you are a cuckservative. Yeah. If you think importing Poles is worthwhile because the white working class are lazy, benefit scrounging scum, you are a cuckservative. If you think saying I don't give a crap what their race or religion is, as long as they respect our culture and British values, makes you sound like a tough right-winger, then you are in fact a cuckservative. If you think white people becoming a minority in their own country against their will is morally acceptable but mass deportations are not, you're a cuckservative. If you think that you're being really clever by calling the left fascists on the premise that both are evil, you're a cuckservative. If you think you can checkmate the left by supporting homos against Islam, you're a cuckservative. And finally, if you believe there is an economic argument for immigration, then you are definitely a cuckservative. So, what one of the consequences of having such a weak conservative party and so few real conservatives left in government and in politics generally, one of the consequences of that is that the left have become very emboldened in attacking people like us because there's nobody else to defend us out there in the mainstream. And so they've become very aggressive in targeting nationalist organisations and patriotic groups. And here are just some of the organisations that they've attacked in the last year or two. This is the group called National Action, who I believe are up on terrorism charges, although...
Three cheers for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. As far as I know, no evidence has yet come forward of actual terrorist activity. I might be wrong about that, but as far as I know, that's the case. Secondly, the English Defence League. It was probably the largest street movement, post-war street movement in England. Now, the leadership of the English Defence League a few years ago became very disillusioned with it and were kind of thinking about possibly... leaving. But the coup de grace was delivered by a Muslim organisation called Quillin, a supposed anti-extremism organisation. And what they did was they paid money to the EDL leaders to make them leave the English Defence League. And then afterwards they crowed about it, saying, "We decapitated the EDL." Which to me is a very strange turn of phrase for somebody who's supposed to be a reformed Muslim extremist, decapitated. And so that was the end of the EDL. Scotland Awake was a new party which was rejected by the Electoral Commission, so it was banned before it even started. Scottish Dawn also banned. Over in Scandinavia, there's a wonderful movement called the Nordic Resistance. They have a lot of followers in Sweden, and they did have a lot of followers in Finland until the Finnish government banned them. Generational Identity were infiltrated by the far left. This character you probably know.
That's
Jez. That's Jez. The London Forum was infiltrated by the far left. Jez Turner runs the London Forum.
I know him, but I didn't know they'd been infiltrated by the...
Yeah, there were a couple of journalists managed to get their way. And even Anne-Marie Waters' organisation has been infiltrated by left-wing journalists. This one I can't really explain. I mean, look at them. It's Walter Mitty and Marilyn.
She's all right. I don't mind her.
I can't see any rational explanation for this pairing, unless it was some kind of hunter trap. I know, maybe I'm being paranoid, but seems to me there's something weird about that. But in any case, it's another nail in the coffin of UKIP. Now, these are two people that I have a great deal of respect for. There's Paul Golding and Jada Franson. Leaders of Britain First. I've been fortunate to get to know them a bit over the last few months. I was hoping to help them launch their May local election campaign. They had big plans to run many candidates for the local elections in May, and they had some really good people lined up. And then, lo and behold, they're jailed on, I don't know what for exactly, for shouting, for saying bad things about Muslim paedophiles. I'm still not exactly sure what they were in prison for. But the effect of that, because of the length of their jail terms, they're now ineligible to stand for election in local elections for the next 5 years, which I suspect was the whole purpose of the exercise.
Excuse me, do you have to have a prison address for her? Because
I do, actually. Yes. For both of them, I've got prison address. So you, yeah. And I would say, please, you know, you might have your differences with Jada and Paul, but they're on our side. They're very courageous people. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you've got a moment to write a little card, a little thank you message, yeah, send it to the prison, make them feel
better. That's what I would like to do, yes.
Give them a bit of encouragement. Mm-hmm. Even these two cuties from North America, from the alt-light, as it's called, the kind of...
Welcome those to Plymouth.
The less radical wing of the alt-right, yes, they're both from North America. I think the one on the left is Canadian. They were refused entry into Britain for being so-called far-right. Now, it makes me laugh. If the authorities think that these two are far-right, they're going to get the shock of their lives when a genuine far-right movement emerges in this country, because they really have got it completely wrong. Now, as well as closing down organisations, one of the things that the left likes to do to people like us is to try and discredit us and to slander us so that we will lose our jobs, or that our families or friends will reject us. And this process is called doxing. And actually, Millennial Woes, who was due to speak here today, is one of the victims of doxing. He's had big problems with the left trying to slander him and sending malicious documents to his friends and family. And that's one of the things that the left do to try and close us down. And I've actually experienced some of this myself recently. After working in research management for a number of years, I wanted to go back to doing research. And I applied for a research fellowship position at Falmouth University in Cornwall. And I was offered the job, and I was really looking forward to it. A nice few years doing interesting research on the beautiful Cornwall coast. But as I've discovered in life, You know, whenever you're feeling pleased with yourself and things are going well, that's the time you should be most nervous. And sure enough, the university withdrew the job offer because of my supposedly abhorrent right-wing views. So,
welcome, right-wing.
The press coverage wasn't all that favourable, but I managed to get a couple of good quotes in. Let's see. One of the things I said is that by excluding educated dissenting, i.e. non-left liberal voices, the universities are limiting high-level debate and discussion of some of the most pressing issues of our time, such as mass immigration, Islamization, and globalisation. If the academic elites find my views and those of others like me so deplorable and are so confident of their own moral and intellectual correctness, then why are they so damn terrified of engaging with us?
Well, fortunately. Did they get printed then?
Sorry?
Did your reports get printed?
Yeah, that was quoted in the Cornwall paper.
Oh, well, that's what
it's like. It's some illegality to actually admit to that, though, because the law states you cannot discriminate against people on political.
Well, what they're saying,
that's easy for us to say. Right?
What they're saying is that my position is in violation of their equality and diversity.
So they get around the law
and stuff, but I don't know. But so anyway, I was fired before the job even started. But this is the way it goes.
I didn't realise that. I would like to have written a letter to the newspaper. I'd known it. That was in the Cornish packet, wasn't it?
Now, what happened was that when they sent the rejection.
When was this? When was this?
This was only last week.
Oh, it's still a live issue. Oh, right.
So what I did was I wrote back to them, and I also included the local press in my email. Now, that's a risky thing to do because they could easily attack you and say this guy's a terrible right-wing fascist. But I thought it would be worth doing because there was a freedom of speech issue here and I thought the newspapers might pick up on it. And they did partly. And actually, some of the comments on those articles, people are saying, isn't it a terrible thing that the far left controls our university? So it's hopefully promoted some discussion of that important issue because, you know, I've worked in academia for many years and they have been taken over by the far left.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
At least 80% of academics in universities are self-declared leftists. Mm. Free speech has been closed down. You know, when you get people like Jacob Rees-Mogg going to university to try and speak, the fascist thugs go, the anti-fascist thugs come in and make it impossible for him to speak. So we've got a terrible situation in academia at the moment. And also on the internet they're closing things down. There's an article about how the police are hunting down Facebook users. People have made offensive comments about Muslim grooming gangs, would you believe? And the police regularly remind us that we should be monitoring our comments and censoring ourselves because they're going to investigate us if we don't. And the problem is that, you know, the Crown Prosecution Service has this definition of hate crime, which is so vague. You could twist it and turn it and manipulate it to arrest anybody you wanted. They talk about hate crimes, including hostility, and at the bottom here they say, but there's no legal definition of hostility. So we use the everyday understanding of the word, which includes ill will, spite, contempt, prejudice, unfriendliness, antagonism, resentment, and dislike. So if you're resenting your immigrant neighbours for any reason, if you're unfriendly towards them, you could well be guilty of a hate crime.
And what about hope not hate? Would they be guilty of a hate crime by showing disapproval of us? Would that the venomous way?
It doesn't work that way round, would it?
It doesn't work that way.
Why not?
It never works
that way.
Well,
we never know.
And so here's a police officer out and about informing the public that they should not be unfriendly to immigrants.
No.
Otherwise,
they can do what they like to us.
This is the woman who's in charge of the Crown Prosecution Service, and her goal, really, one of her goals, is to kind of criminalise anything which is offensive to anybody.
That leftist gal.
You know, she's absolutely hardline leftist, and she would like to criminalise anything that people like.
What's her name?
Her name's Alison Saunders.
Oh, that is Alison.
Ah. I knew the name
of Alison Saunders.
You
yeah.
Write a letter to her. Alison Saunders, she's wasting
I mean, to me, she looks like Big Brother's big sister. Yeah.
It's as though she should work in a concentration camp.
She does, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's got that look.
Now, worryingly, it's not just the public sector that is kind of banning people and closing people down. It's also the private sector. A lot of private companies now have these policies, which so-called diversity and equality policies, which they use as a basis for shutting down people like us. These are some of the companies that have banned, censored, or withheld services from so-called right-wing groups or individuals, and they include some of the big players like Facebook, Google, Patreon, the fundraising site, PayPal, Twitter, YouTube, as you know, recently closed down Pat Condell, I think.
He
shut down a couple of his videos, but anyway, these companies have all been involved in suppressing freedom of speech at some stage. And of course, the left wing are crowing about this, they absolutely love it. A character called Jonathan Greenblatt said, "You've got a powerful statement by public companies about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable."
It's even gold as green.
So, you know, the point is, these people are unelected, the CEOs of these companies have not been elected by anybody, and they're telling us what we can and can't say online. So, what I'm saying here is that we're terribly vulnerable. We're out there exposed, we're being shot down like ducks at a fairground. We don't seem to have any defence against it, we're in total disarray and we're ineffectual. I don't think anybody here would disagree with that, would
you?
So, what I'm saying is I think that we're too exposed. We're like, we give too much away. We're like the poker player who can't keep a straight face, who shows his hand to his opponent. And as a consequence, the opponent is always one step ahead and keeps winning the games. And that's the situation we're in. And we have to start keeping our cards close to our chest. And we also have to learn how to exploit our networks. Now, there's a very good website called America, written by a guy called Brett Stevens. And he points out that the left is actually incredibly good at organising itself in these networks, and it's something that we could learn from. He says, "Our future involves creating even more events that force a meeting engagement between the neurotics who support the death of civilization and the outrighters who want to restore Western civilization. This will require organising. Here's an example of how to turn out people, cribbed from Organising for Social Change, the activist manual published by the Midwest Academy, which has been around since 1973 and has trained over 30,000 activists, some of whom went on to found their own training schools. Say that you run an organisation that wants to impress a city councilman and you've landed a meeting. You want your group to look bigger than it is. You've got 15 dedicated people you know will go, but you want to show the councilman 60 people. The first thing you do is get 10 people from other groups. That leaves 35 people. To get them, you don't post an ad on Craigslist. You look in your database of people who've signed on your petitions or whatever. Call and ask them to come. If they say yes, call them again in a day or two in advance to confirm. Of the people who say yes twice, only half will actually show up. So you need 70 people to say yes twice." And so this is basically the process by which the left will exploit their networks to make things happen. The left realised that people could be delegated to perform very simple granular tasks, like in a factory, by giving them procedures in the form of bullet points, checklists, worksheets and anecdotes. This allows a few bureaucrat managers to mobilise thousands in the form of small cells managed by intermediate level leaders. So I mentioned there the power of the network, as opposed to the conventional hierarchical organisation. And there's a very interesting book called Networks and Net Wars, written by a couple of security experts from America. And they say that the information revolution favours the rise of network forms of organisation. The network appears to be the next major form of organisation, long after tribes, hierarchies and markets, to come into its own to redefine societies, and in so doing, the nature of conflict and cooperation. And I won't go into great detail here, but they talk about five levels of practice in organising a network. The first level is the organisation level, the actual design of the network. The second is the narrative level, the story being told. The third is the doctrinal level, the collaborative strategies and methods. Number four is the technological level, the information systems used. And number five is the social level, the personal ties that assure loyalty and trust. The strength of the network depends on its functioning well across all five levels. Now, if we look at the way networks might be organised, the so-called network shapes or topologies, we can find many different shapes. If you look at bottom left, this is a chain network. Each of those nodes or circles represents a group or individual. Each of the lines represents a line of communication between them. And you can see that for the first node, the first group to communicate with the last one, it has to go through two intermediaries. The next type of network is the hub, where you have a central organizer who is in communication with all the subgroups, but the subgroups are not in direct communication with each other. The star network is even more connected. And finally, you have the all-channel network at bottom right, where every node in the network, every individual or group, can talk to everybody else directly. So these are different kinds of networks that exist. Now, the second level I mentioned was the narrative level. Like other forms of organisation, networks are held together by the narratives or stories that people tell. These narratives provide an expression of people's experiences and interests. Stories express a sense of identity and belonging, who we are, why we have come together, and what makes us different from them. And I think we have, as a group of nationalists, we have a very strong narrative. We have very strong ideas and beliefs about identity and belonging and what we believe in and what we want to do. And these narratives have to be appealing to external audiences, because it's no good us just talking to ourselves all the time. One of the things we have to do is reach out to the general public and build our movement. And so that narrative has to be appealing to them. Third is a doctrinal level, I won't go into that. Except to say that one of the techniques the left uses very well is called swarming, which occurs when the dispersed units of a network converge on a target from multiple directions. This is something Antifa does very well. The overall aim is sustainable pulsing. Swarm networks must be able to coalesce rapidly, then dissever and redisperse, immediately ready to recombine for a new pulse. Fourth, the technological level. I mentioned earlier how a lot of the platforms were closing us down. Now, in response to that, some of the technology people who are on our side have actually developed alternative platforms so that we don't have to rely on the mainstream platforms. One of them is called Gab, which is a free speech alternative to Twitter. We've got goodgopher.com, which is the anti-Google. PewTube, which has been used by people like Pat Condell, as an alternative to YouTube. Patreon, alternative to Patreon. Metapedia, the Tor browser is very good. You might find in libraries and public places these days, a lot of the systems will actually prevent you from accessing right-wing websites. Even things like Jihad Watch, you can't access from your local library using a normal browser. However, if you use the Tor browser, it will enable you to bypass a lot of those restrictions, so you will have proper access to the internet. Yeah. There are plenty of these alternatives.
Can you possibly print off this? Because I can't take them all in.
Yeah, it's too much. It's too much to take in. I can probably put this presentation online. So.
Yes, because it gives us a chance to.
Yeah, sure. And here's a very good one for the younger people. It's called wasp.love. It's a pro-Christian dating site for those wishing to preserve their heritage. Be fruitful and multiply, join Wasp Love today.
Wait for me, but.
And the final level of network organisation is the social underpinnings. Now, this is very important in terms of security. We've had this big problem of people infiltrating organisations, people that we don't know and can't verify, Now, if you're organised, if your network is set up correctly, so that you only gradually introduce people who are trusted and known, then you can remove a lot of that risk of infiltration. The functioning of a network depends on how well and in what ways the members are personally known and connected to each other. Strong personal ties, often ones that rest on friendship and bonding experiences, ensure high degrees of trust and loyalty. So that's the kind of theory of networks. I just want to look quickly at a couple of examples. The first example is a fairly hierarchical structure, typical hierarchical structure, of a patriotic organisation called Reconquista Germania. Now, they were heavily involved in promoting the Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, party in Germany, which was very successful in the last German elections. It's a far, you might call a far-right party, nationalist party. And a lot of their support was actually gained online through the work of Reconquista Germania, which is described as the biggest patriotic German language Discord channel. Discord is one of these social media channels. And the purpose of the organisation was to ensure the strongest possible showing for AfD in the Bundestag. They have a clear hierarchical structure using military language. The main issues are immigration, cultural displacement, terrorism. They are able to create unlikely collaborations due to visible successes, the entertainment factor and anonymity. People can take part without revealing their true identities. And of course they use internet memes extensively, using trolling armies and social media bots to spread memes. One of the great things they do is they create parody accounts on Facebook and Twitter. So they'll set up an account with a name that sounds very similar to a prominent politician. And then they will post ridiculous, ludicrous statements on it in order to discredit that politician. It's a very effective tactic. And in the weeks before the election, pro-AfD hashtags reached the top five trending hashtags in Germany multiple times. And partly as a result of that, the AfD won 94 seats in the Bundestag. Very quickly, a second example. There are a couple of right-wing websites based in America which are attempting to use their popularity to set up real-world networks of activists distributed around different countries. And the idea is that groups of men, groups of nationalist men, will get together in their own cities or neighbourhoods and engage in social activity, bonding activity, training, education, and political activism independently, just in their own locality, and that these various groups would have some kind of loose contact with each other to create a network. So you might start off with a situation like this, with a relatively small number of groups, not with just a few connections between them, ending up eventually with a mature network like this, where you have groups all over the country speaking to each other, in communication with each other. And if you look on the left-hand side, each node, each group might be structured something like this, where in the middle you have a central organizer, and the group is broken down into subgroups for things like recruitment, activism, fundraising, media. And so within the group itself, you have a kind of shallow hierarchy, but the network itself is non-hierarchical.
You said book clubs up on top left-hand.
Book club. They call them book clubs.
Ah, I see.
But it's a kind of... it's just a term that they use to kind of describe these groups.
Yeah.
Now, the advantages of that kind of network structure as compared with the conventional hierarchy, the organisational design is flat. There is no single central leadership or command or headquarters that can be targeted. So whereas something like the EDL could be destroyed simply by destroying the leadership, if you don't have that kind of hierarchical organisation with one leader, you can't do that. The network as a whole has little to no hierarchy. In fact, there may be multiple leaders. Decision-making and operations are decentralized, allowing for local initiative and autonomy. So all of these groups operate autonomously without any direct control from above and do their own thing, although they might be in communication with each other. The offensive potential of these groups is that they're adaptable, flexible, versatile, and can respond to opportunities as they come up. And in terms of defensive potential, they're redundant. And what that means is you could knock out half a dozen of those nodes on the right and it wouldn't break the network. The network would still exist. And this makes them robust and resilient in the face of attack. And that type of structure has been called a segmented, excuse the terminology, segmented, polycentric, ideologically integrated network, or SPIN. It is fluid, dynamic, and spinning out into mainstream society. And that's the purpose, really, to try and have these networks constantly growing and reaching out to people in the mainstream society. And the purpose of the book clubs will be to make friends, to promote friendship, to share the worldview, to give young men confidence, education, martial arts, political activism. There are all sorts of things that you could do within the context of a book club that will help educate young men and women, help them to bond and become effective groups within their local.
How did it suggest you launch the initial book club? I mean, in Plymouth, for example, what do you do to get it going?
Well, it requires a catalyst, somebody who's going to give advice on how to do it. And these two websites that I mentioned are actually providing instructions on how to set the clubs up. Secondly, you need a local organiser who's willing to take on the responsibility of organising things locally. So you have a local organiser who's taking guidance from the catalyst organisation, which in this case is a website. But they're not getting direct instructions from the website. They're just getting guidance on how to set it up. And they will then reach out to other people they know in their own community, bring them together to create this small local group. So it relies upon having, you know, a fairly active and dynamic person within each area. And a writer called Roy Battier said, we want to build stronger, smarter, better men. And so that is what is at the core of any healthy revolutionary movement. There's a writer from, I don't know if you know much about the Manosphere. It's the kind of the online organisation of men's rights activists. And there's a very prominent figure within that sphere called Roosh V. He's written a lot of books. And he talks about the resistance pyramid, and what he says is that before you can go about changing your community or your society, you have to have individual improvement. You have to help young men and women to become strong mentally and physically. You have to help them develop financial resilience through finding alternative sources of income, starting their own businesses and so on. You then have to introduce them to this thing, this global information warfare, which is basically the battle of ideas. It goes on the internet, help them to understand how that works. And at that stage, you can then go on to tribal organisation, which is this gathering of people from within your local community to form a little tribal group that can work together. And once you've done that, you're in a position to start doing local resistance and self-defence within your local community. Okay, I just want to show you very quickly now. These local groups who want to get engaged in activism, it's very important to try and be inventive and imaginative and do things differently. And I want to show a few examples of groups that have done some really fantastic stunts and events in public, which have gathered a lot of attention. This is Generation Identity in Austria.
Thank you.
Stunt. It gathered a lot of attention. It also made the central point about the ultimate consequences of refugees' welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another very inventive stunt. The Spanish government actually banned people from holding public demonstrations outside public buildings. So a group of enterprising activists decided to set up a holographic protest.
Technology. The first hologram protest in the world's history was held Saturday in the Spanish capital when thousands of people marched past the parliament in Madrid. Not physically though, but by the means of a hologram projected outside the building. The gag law prohibits anyone from protesting at any time without authorization. While many face the danger of being fined €30,000 when participating in unauthorized protests outside government buildings, it seems that with this hologram demonstration, a loophole has been found. Because how can you fine a hologram? Despite the gag law being introduced last year, protests still occur almost every week in Spain. A day after the virtual demonstration, anarchists held an actual demonstration in the streets of Madrid, protesting against the latest police arrests.
This is one of my favourites. It's a group of Swedish patriots who decided to go into one of the rich areas of Stockholm. And what they do is they take in a sound system, blasting out the Islamic call to prayer at 5 o'clock in the morning. This is a rich area where a lot of the wealthy politicians and journalists live.
That's clever, isn't it?
And of course, they didn't like it very much. Unfortunately, the police came on to spoil the fun, but it was a fantastic, another thing I've seen quite a lot of lately is taking existing cultural products, whether they be videos or paintings or whatever, and twisting them and distorting them in our favour. In other words, reinterpreting cultural products so that they work for us. And this is quite an amusing one. The band U2 had just released a new single and a video to go with it. and somebody had written an alternative commentary to go with it. And what they said was, the white supremacist and neo-Nazi band U2 has released a music video in support of Donald Trump and the KKK takeover of America. The stop-motion masterpiece compiled for the new song, Get Out of Your Own Way, features an entire series of alt-right and neo-Nazi tropes. At the outset, we see a pale white man kissing a female Pepe meme. Heroic Klansmen march past the White House where they are greeted by Donald Trump. The video ends with Donald Trump's glorious wall. It's a truly incredible production. It's a kind of tongue-in-cheek reinterpretation of popular media, which I think is very amusing. So what we're really trying to do here, I don't know if you've come across the concept of the Overton window. The Overton window is what defines what's acceptable in public discourse at any given time. And what we're trying to do is to shift that Overton window downwards here on the diagram, so that ideas which are now radical or unthinkable become thinkable. Things like mass deportation, these are taboo subjects at the moment.
Yes.
Part of our task is to bring those subjects into the mainstream so that they're topics of legitimate discussion. And that is called shifting the Overton window. Andrew Anglin makes this point. He says the key goal right now should be logically continuing to normalise our ideas to get to the point where you can say these things that we believe in the open, publicly, without being physically attacked, without losing your job, without getting kicked off the internet. And that is not far out of our reach. So really, this has been about basically the network form of organisation and how that could work for us, how that could make us less exposed, less vulnerable to attack, more resilient and more effective. A couple of writers on this subject have said the absence of structure, leadership and formal organisation, once considered a weakness, have become a major asset. And seemingly chaotic groups have challenged and defeated established institutions. The more chaotic it appears, the more resilient it is. And the more we try to control it, the more unpredictable it becomes. So this is really the purpose of my talk, to try and stimulate some discussion around this topic. Now, there's some very interesting parallels in nature. This phenomenon is called murmuration. It's where you have a huge flock of birds. And initially they seem chaotic, they all fly in different directions. And then after a while, these beautiful patterns start emerging. Now, these are spontaneous, but they're not controlled by any one bird. There's not one bird orchestrating the whole thing. It simply emerges naturally from the interactions between individual birds at the local level. So, for example, a bird might operate according to the rule of staying close to its three or four nearest neighbours without colliding with them. Simple rules like that are enough to create this amazing complex behaviour. And similarly, I think if we have a dense network of activists all doing their own thing, acting autonomously, according to the same ideology, then some kind of beautiful overall macro pattern could emerge from that process. And so that's really the point that I'm trying to make with this presentation. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Yes, anybody like to ask questions?
So really you're saying just get active, do something. You don't have to be with an organisation, and just do something intelligent and as far as one's talents permit one to have an effect.
Yeah, I think that's basically take the initiative, do something for yourself. Yeah. You don't have to have a large organisation to tell you what to do. If you feel strongly about these issues and three or four of your friends feel strongly about these issues, you can start your own organisation, start to do things, make contact with similar organisations nearby, and you become part of that network. We are in this terribly difficult situation, but as far as I can see, continuing the way that we have been doing, it's not going to get us anywhere. And we have to start thinking about different ways of organising and doing things. Now, this might not be the right way, but I just want to try and stimulate its discussion about how we can organise better.
Have you got any advice or guidance that you can offer on when we speak to people that may not be familiar with our patriotic nationalist movement and attracting empathy and sympathy from people that are outside of the nationalist movement?
Well,
the narrative, when you mentioned the narrative,
yeah, I mean,
how you would approach those people?
What I would say is that within our body of ideology, there are some ideas which are probably not acceptable yet to the majority of people.
Yeah,
and exactly. There are some other ideas which speak directly to their concerns. For example, loss of jobs due to mass immigration, suppression of wages due to mass immigration, not being able to get a council house because of immigration.
Yeah.
Those kinds of issues speak to people's actual lived experience. So if you can find ideas which actually resonate with their lived experience, I think you're on to a good start. But to come out with some of the more radical ideas that we have straight away, it's just going to antagonise people.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's taken me maybe 8 or 9 years to go from mildly conservative to where I am now. It's not a fast process. You bring those people on board in a fairly gentle way, you know, they will develop in their own way.
I often think, you mentioned immigration, the jobs that have to be done that we don't want to do, guest workers can do those jobs, and the Arab republics are a wonderful working example where they have large numbers of guest workers doing all the jobs that the Qataris don't do. 7 guest workers in Qatar for every Qatari. So you can have all the jobs you want done by foreigners, by immigrants if you like, but they have no right to stay there after the job's over. And I think as an alternative to immigration is the pressing of the guest worker idea. Now, if that can be put in a very simple,
yeah, well, they did that. That's what they did in Germany with the Turkish workers, but they failed to send them back.
Yeah, precisely.
That's
precisely.
That's
precisely
the is what they, but we don't have to fail in that way.
The German Gastarbeiters were only supposed to be there temporarily.
Yes, but that was because of the pressure on Germany at the time. I can't remember the details why. But they didn't have to do that. They chose to do it.
Yes.
Well, I kind of get what you're saying, and I'm in favour of short contract workers for highly specialised jobs that we don't have the people to do. But the problem is, if somebody starts having a family in this country and their kids are born here,
yeah,
it becomes much more difficult to kick them out. Mm. And also, you know, if there's an endless supply of cheap foreign labour, what incentive is there for our companies to properly pay
and to
properly train our own youngsters? Mm. I mean, I think our own youngsters have lost the work ethic in many cases. Mm. We need to introduce that, but we also need to provide them with good quality training.
Mm.
And companies aren't going to do that if they can get highly qualified people from abroad who are going to work for a minimum wage.
Mm. You know? Engaging people is interesting because I've had several conversations, even with students, and I usually do it when they're finished, at the end of their term, studies. And if you engage them in this kind of conversation and say, well, you've got to go out into the world now and get yourself a job, I suppose. Yeah, you know. What a pity you've got to compete with all that foreign cheap labour. They glaze over. They don't even, and I've done it not just once or twice, lots of times. They can't even engage in a conversation. They just glaze over.
Yeah.
They can't accept it. But I think a way around that is to actually then put it to them, what would you do about that?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's something I don't normally do, I normally just walk away, but you're right, if you just go in gentle and then say, you know, what do you think should be done? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, so I think
it would make them think.
There's an answer, if you've ever knocked on doorsteps,
yeah, exactly.
And I expect most people here have. It's a difficult thing to do, to kind of make a real contact with the person you're speaking to.
Yeah, I've had a little bit of success with people like that. I don't talk about nationalism at all. I just talk about what's happening in the world, what the establishment are doing. First, waking those people up, putting them onto a website. I don't know if you've heard about the guy, William Engel, and things like UK Column and that. They look at the geopolitics, but they never mention so much race and the differences like that. Just opening things out to people, what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And I get their attention, I say, go and look at this website, and oh, I didn't really realise it was really like that. Then you can start introducing these other, you know, the other things. So one guy, sort of, it was all, you know, he's a student, newly finished student, and it was all sort of, oh, that's racist, this is racist. You know, he had the old doctrine there. And I said, oh, you know, look at these things, these sites. Now, I've told about my experiences with British National Party and that, and it, he listens. He might not agree with me, but at least he listens and he accepts.
Yeah.
So I think you've got to introduce them to what's really going on in the world first, gently.
Yeah.
Get them onto a lot of these websites where they explain the geopolitics, the more in-depth stuff. And like I say, he said, I didn't, that's opened my mind. And now he's listening to me, he wants to know more, and, you know.
Yeah,
I agree.
I can say the other thing is that you've got to remember with our young people, our own young people growing up, they can see what's happening to our country, and maybe they might not voice that directly, but you've got to look at their mindset and they think, well, what does the future hold for me? I've got this degree, I've done this, studied hard, I've studied industrially, and yet there's no real future for me.
So some are starting to find out, yeah, I know a lot of people, you know, they're not getting the jobs, you know.
Well, my impression is, but I don't know much about young people, but my impression is that there's a lot of anger out there.
Yeah.
Amongst young white British people, they're extremely worried about the future.
Not many will argue with you.
But the problem is with that is, like, if you look, see, that's why I sort of try and aim to the more sort of educated middle class people from the middle class areas, where you can open their minds a little bit. With the working class kids, they've been so downtrodden and so disheartened, they've given, you can't get through to them. You can't say, oh, do this, do, you know, they're locked into their football, their video games, all their entertainment. They go, if they're working, they go to work and they blow all their money at the weekend entertaining themselves, and then they just come back to the same old menial job. And they've lost their will.
Well, there was a slide earlier, what happens when the indigenous people are displaced and they end up lost? Nobody looks after them. And that's what you were explaining there, really.
They become like the aborigines of Australia, yeah. And
possibly the genetic things. You know, the old thing about you start off left and end up. You start off voting Labour and you end up voting Conservative as you get older. And that's the genetic thing.
You mentioned with things that are art forms. Really. What about We Shall Overcome? We Shall Overcome. Ourselves, haven't we? The Naked People. We start singing that song with meaning. Some of the other songs of the 60s, protest songs, now really apply to us in the sense of We Shall Overcome. That would annoy the left, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That annoys him very greatly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We Shall Overcome. This tradition. Yeah. Here we are. I don't want to take up any more time because I know
Okay, thank you.
You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.